Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Hilary Prendini Toffoli is a journalist who's earned her stripes across a very wide range of publications, writing on everything from people to politics and all that lies and lives in between. She's what you might call ubiquitous. She's also extraordinarily versatile and enviably well-travelled. Her antennae are constantly a-quiver and she has a nose for a good story. But following decades of paid-for print, she's finally dived into fiction, what's taken her so long. And she has a novel already under her belt and several more in the pipeline, I believe. But significant about Hilary is that she is an Italophile. She's married to not one but two Italians, separately, I might say, the second of which for nearly two decades, whose own boyhood or young manhood has in part informed this book. It's called Loves and Miracles of Pistola. Hilary, congratulations. Lovely to have you here and well done. After all these years, at last, the novel.
Thanks.
So let's talk about the novel. Let's talk about the title of the novel. It's called Loves and Miracles of Pistola. What is that in Italian and what's the story behind the title?
It's Amores e Miracolos de Pistola, and it comes from Life and Miracles of the Saints. And Emilio said to me, you know, that could make a great title for this book. I said, well, I'm not going to make it Life and Miracles. I'm going to make it Loves and Miracles, because that does rather inform the book. I mean, right from the very beginning, he's in love with the most amazing girl in the village, but unfortunately she's marrying someone else. And then he discovers that the marriage isn't going to happen. And that's when all sorts of things, interesting things happen.
They so do. But before we even get our toe in that particular water, you said that title in Italian so beautifully. What's your thing for Italy? Where has all this Italianate stuff come from?
Well, look, I think I did live in Spain for a while. And the Spaniards are not, for about 4 years, in fact, they're not that different from the Italians. Though they do differ, let's not confuse them. But when I was young, we used to travel on the Loi Triestino backwards and forwards. It was cheaper than air flights in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And those Italians were amazing. The food was amazing. The music was lovely. And so were the officers. And I think that might have had something to do with it. And look, it's a wonderful country.
Yeah.
Wonderful country.
Yeah, I bet the officers had something to do with it. And I referred there to the fact that you had been married to two Italians, but I hasten to add separately. So I think that you were so quite seduced by the whole Italian thing, but you also spent some time there.
Oh, yeah, we have. No, but after I married the second Italian, we stayed with his family in a little village called Roverbella up there in the north between Mantua and Verona. Beautiful little village. And we went there often. We even stayed there once for 3 months. But when I wrote the book, I wasn't going to call it that. I gave it a new name. There's no such thing as Campino, because a lot of those people are Emilio's relatives and friends that appear in the book. One or two still have the same names. We sort of thought, are they going to? So far, they haven't read the book. It hasn't been translated into Italian. Penguin Random House has the rights in South Africa. They're still trying to sell it to overseas. I don't know whether it might be too South African for the overseas people, because the second half, as you know, is when they come to South Africa. But I won't jump ahead now.
No, let's not jump ahead. And I'm longing to find out more about Emilio now that he's been named, when we can find out a little bit more about him, because it's his boyhood, his stories that have fueled this so wonderfully. But before we do, I just want to go back about you having been a journalist for so many years. You've written about so many different things. But suddenly there was fiction. Has it been bottom drawer story? Have you had novel always waiting to be written? When did the novel idea?
Well, I did start writing a novel about two decades ago, which I've since resuscitated, and that's kind of now hanging around ready to come out. It's not nostalgia. It's also based on a family member. I tend to base things on family members, because I have one that I've based on my grandfather's Siege of Ladysmith diary that's also more or less ready and hanging around. But this one I started with Emilio, because his stories of the village were so fabulous. I started it as a food story, in fact, which is why food does come through all the way through. And then one day I remembered that I'd had this interview with these guys that had come to South Africa to be waiters on the train. Should I actually get into that whole story?
Well, before you do, what you said there, I wrote this piece. And it seems to me that as a journalist of, I don't know, 30, 40 years, whatever it is, you must have huge resources of material. Obviously, you're a researcher, but are you a notebook keeper?
I've got all the stories. I've got all the stories in files.
You've got the stories.
I've got them in files. Okay. So if I need to look back for certain details, like, for example, when I was doing this and I was looking back at the story I did on the guys who came to be on the trains, I mean, I've got all the comments they made and I've got the characters. I've changed a little bit, but, I mean, I've used them. I also did a story on the 96,000 prisoners of war who were in Cullinan in South Africa after the war. 96,000. In fact, I wrote a whole opera, sort of. I wrote a film script on it, which I have not been able to get published because, I mean, I have not been able to get it on the screen because it's too many people, it's too expensive. But it's about how they had operas. Every weekend they had an opera and the guys used to don the wigs to do the soprano parts. But I mean, so I've done a lot of research all the way through on Italians in different ways. I've written about Italian food for different magazines. So, you know, and I've done all the other things. I've done investigative journalism, various people, the crimes, the bodies. It's been an interesting career.
You're almost suffering from overload of information.
Yeah, absolutely.
And reading your book, I kept thinking, where did that become? How did she know that? Where has this bit come from? So obviously you have all this information, not just on file, but somewhere deep in your soul.
Mm, which is where the characters, I think, come from.
And let's go back to the 100 or so, 110 young stewards. For whom were you writing that story? And how did you come across that story?
Emilio started a food store called Emilio's Food Store in a cafe next to the house where we lived in Bradar Street in Aranjuez. And one of the people who supplied him with food for that food store was an Italian whose name Luciano Bersella. And he said to Emilio one day, you know that I came to South Africa in 1954 with 110 other young Italians. And he said, you know, it would make an interesting story for your wife. Isn't she a journalist? And I was working for Style magazine. And I thought, this is fascinating. So immediately we launched upon that. Then he got me to interview all the others who are still around. There's one in the guy in Sea Point who's got La Perla was one of them. And then there's still a guy, amazingly enough, still he's got a pizzeria in Fishhook, and I'm just trying to remember what the name is, but I think he's still there. And then there were various others who stayed on after they'd had their 3 years on the trains and started these restaurants. And then Luciano said to me, he said, you know, at the time there was no food, there were no restaurants, there was no Italian food. People ate in places like Kelvin, they ate in clubs, they ate in hotels. It was all that kind of French food, heavy food. There was, I mean, crayfish, hot crayfish with lots of rich sauces and things. We taught them about Italian food that was simple, basic. You know, the food had to be fresh. And most of them at that stage, they had Heinz spaghetti on toast. That's what South Africans would eat. As far as they were concerned, that was Italian food.
Loud and clear in your book comes across the way Italians are fed. You know, their souls have been fed by the sort of food they eat versus the sort of food that we eat in South Africa. But let's go back to those 110 young guys. In 1954, they came here to be stewards on trains. Just explain that story.
Well, there was a huge network of trains in South Africa, the overnight sleeping cars that went to Mozambique. They went to northern and southern Rhodesia, which is what Zimbabwe was at the time. And they went to what was called, not Namibia, it was called Southwest Africa. So there were all of these. And at the time, the nationalists didn't want to have black waiters because they didn't like the idea of black waiters seeing white women in their 90s early in the morning when they brought them coffee at the crack of dawn, with pretty awful coffee. And apparently the young white South Africans thought that being waiters on trains was beneath them, and they couldn't get enough. They just simply couldn't get enough waiters. So that was when Ben Schoeman, who was the Minister of Transport, said, well, let's go to Italy. In Italy, waiting is a profession. These are terrific. And Ben Schoeman had Italian prisoners of war on his farm, and he knew that they had a work ethic and they were terrific and he liked them. So that was when the South Africans went and started interviewing all these young Italians, and thousands of them wanted to get out of Italy because there was no work after the war. Now we're talking about not even 10 years after the war, 1954. War had ended in 1945, and Italy was still trying to pick itself up. I mean, later on it became the this wonderful design hub. But I mean, at that stage, Italy was pretty desperate. And so, and they were young. I mean, they were sort of 16, 15, 16, 17, a lot of them, as is Pistola, very young, a young teenager. And I thought it was such an interesting story that I thought, well, I'll put Emilio in the story. I'll turn him into one of these young guys who's come to South Africa. And it just took off from there. And then I thought, of course, all the interesting things that were happening in South Africa under the apartheid government is going to make a lot of an interesting story for South Africans who still don't really know. I mean, it's quite a long time ago. I kind of lived through it, but a lot of them don't know, especially the young ones. So from that point of view, I thought it could make a good story.
It makes a hell of a story. It's a sort of intergenerational, multi-layered story because there's so many things going on here. But you mentioned Emilio. Let's talk about Emilio because he has definitely informed this. Is he much of a narrator? I mean, it's his boyhood village that you went to that has given you so much background information. But is he the sort of guy that talked about, you know, when I was a kid, has he told you a lot of stories?
Oh, no, he talks all the time. You cannot stop him. I mean, he talks all the time. And it's all about things like, for example, he told me how food was so important that, you know, instead of saying to somebody like you would in any other village, you know, good morning, how are you? Have you had a good day? You'd say, have you had a good meal? And I remember him being at some funeral, and he said, you see the coffin going down, and some gnarled old fellow says, oh, well, poor bugger, no more tagliatelle for him. You know, that's it. I mean, food's the bottom line. I mean, that's what it is.
So it was the bottom line. So it sort of kind of started off as the top line for this particular book, but then we get the Italian stewards, and then we get South Africa. And this is where your journalistic experience comes way back in, or comes right back in, because you have had so many experiences as a journalist. So as much as we talk about Italy, we talk about what's going on in South Africa. What are the sort of experiences that you found yourself bringing into the book?
Well, look, I did interview some people who'd been in Sophia Town, amazingly enough, some of those singers that I think even still alive. And that was pretty hard, just hearing about that. And then, of course, there's that whole Miriam Makeba story. She sang it, and she sang for a movie that they made in Sophia Town, which I knew about. I've done research on that. She went abroad with that movie, and that was when they banned her. So I thought that part has got to be all said. I mean, that whole Sophia Town story is a good story. And then through all of that, which I'm not going to, you know, give you the details of because it spoils the story, but he eventually leaves, he's forced to leave Joburg on the trains and come down to Cape Town. And that's when he gets involved because Boer Kaap now was another story that I had actually done more recently when they were fighting against these buildings that are going up around them. The fight continues. I think they recently won one of their fights. But I interviewed a lot of people there in the Boer Kaap. I went to the Tana Baru Cemetery there where Tuanguru is buried. I heard all about those, you know, all about that. And I thought, well, this is just another fascinating part, especially when I came across a bit that Edie du Plessis is, I don't know whether you even know this, Nancy, but the reason that Boer Kaap did not get bulldozed like Sophia Town and Salt River, that whole area, District 6, was Edie du Plessis wrote a book called The Malays. And it was all about the fact that these people had been there for 200 years and that they should be left there. And he was actually a member of parliament. He was an Afrikaans member of the apartheid government. And he fought for them. And that's why they didn't get rid of the Boer Kaap. They called it the Malay Quarter, which is something that rankles with these people who think it should be called Scotcher Kloof in those days or Boer Kaap. But he preserved it, even though, in fact, it wasn't all Malays. There were a lot of other people. They were kicked out. It was kind of became a Malay quarter. And I thought that is another fascinating piece of South Africa. South Africa's got a lot of fascinating pieces of history that people know about vaguely, but not in depth, in fact.
Yes, and what you've done is you've introduced people to little bits of it. And it sounds like, you know, with each little bit, there's a whole submergence of more of the same story. I long to know how you constructed the story, given that you had so many elements that you were stringing together, not least food. But maybe tell us about Pistola, because he's the key. I mean, there he is, this young guy in Campino, is it? Campino,
yes.
The little village. And it's his life and his loves. Tell us about Pistola. Describe him.
Well, listen, I think Pistone.
What does he look like? Does he look like anybody you know?
No, he's good looking, but he doesn't realize he's good looking. There's that scene where he goes to this. Well, this is based on a real story in Emilio's life. I mean, a lot of those are real. He actually was in a movie with, amazingly enough, Franco Zeffirelli. Hmm. And Luchino Visconti at the time, and Emilia was just an extra, and all the villagers were extras. And he goes there, and they said to Emilia, who was very good looking when he was younger, I mean, he really was stunning, he looked like a movie star, and they said to him, you know what, they're interested in people like you at Cinecittà in Rome. And Emilia was terrified. They were all gay, very sophisticated. He didn't know what to do with these people. So he kind of didn't carry on. But so he is very good looking. But being a villager, he doesn't realize how good looking he actually is. And also because the fact that this woman he's in love with has kind of rejected him, makes him not. He's insecure. He's a naive, insecure, sweet, sweet, lovely guy who always thinks about other people. He's very sensitive. He's introvert. He lives with his grandfather, who's a total extrovert and a very difficult man. And let me tell you, is based on Emilia, who can be quite difficult. And the odd spaghetti that hits the wall, Emilio. And then he recognizes himself in the book.
And he is in the book. He's Nonno Mario.
Yeah, he's him. That's him.
Incarnate. Mm. Did he help you co-write this? I mean, I imagine that you not only sort of took down his stories, but consulted with him as you were writing it.
No. In fact, he didn't even read it until it had been passed by Penguin, and they said, we like it and we want, the reader had said, we want it. And then he said, listen, get them to give me a printout because he doesn't want to read it online. And they gave him a printout, and he read it because he said, I want to correct your Italian because I want to make sure that all the Italian's spelled correctly. And no, he read it, and he didn't say, listen, you can't make me look so awful or anything like that, nothing. No, but he never helped me write it. Actually, the writing's me. I mean, I'm the journalist. He gave me the information, and I turned it into what it became.
The writing is one thing. I was going to say it's easy to write.
But he's got the sense of humour.
And he's got the sense of humour. So, and he's been the material, the inspiration, et cetera, et cetera. But you're the one who had to write it all down. And the writing, because you have a facility, you've been writing all your life, I believe, when you were a young woman, you just endlessly write stories. So that would have been the easy bit for you. The bit for me that I think must have been quite difficult was the construction, because you have so much there. How did you plan it?
No planning. Mm. No planning, no plotting, nothing. It's what happens. Stephen King says, put a character in an interesting situation and see what happens. And that's exactly what I did, because something would happen, and then I would imagine, God, what are we going to do now? What's he going to do now? And then how will he handle this? And oh, hell, he can't. Can he really do this? Is this what he would have done? And so it just grew. It just grows, that, which is what life is like, which is why I think it's got quite – it doesn't feel that it's sort of plotted. You don't feel the strings of the puppet master. It grows. There's a word for it, organic.
Well, it's organic, and it's not linear, because things – happen. Suddenly he comes across this, without giving anything away here, he comes across this young Muslim woman, and I thought, well, where did that come from?
So Muslim woman he meets on the boat, I met a woman on the boat. I did that boat so many times, as I told you, and I actually met a woman who was coming back from Mecca, and she was terrific, and she remained, I've remembered her ever since, years later, and that's why I thought that he meets this woman, and I thought it was quite a nice way of doing it.
So you really let yourself go. So once you sat down in the morning or whenever you sit down to write, you just would go and see which way it took you. Really, that's how it worked.
Mm. Actually, interestingly. I walk with a dog and I think, now, I'm in a tricky situation. Now, what the hell? How the hell do we get out of this one? You know, what is going to happen now? And you walk, and it's when you're walking somehow or other that things, you know, and when I'm asleep at night, when I can't sleep at night, I'm sort of planning things. Well, how the hell are we going to handle this one? You see, that's what you're always in you've got another obstacle to get over.
And I suppose, I mean, we've spoken a little bit about your experiences as a journalist and the places that you've been. I mean, very, very well travelled. You've been all over the place. I think what you've also collected along the way are all sorts of characters, because I suppose if you're in a bit of a dilemma as to what happens next, you bring on another character. Who are these people? They're very real. They have a sort of tangible personalities.
honestly, Nancy, I don't know. They come. They just pop up. They pop up. I don't know who they are. I mean, I really don't.
But they provide huge amounts of colour and huge amounts of language. You're very good. You're very fond of dialogue. Are you a great listener to hear how people speak?
Well, I speak a couple of languages, so maybe that helps. I speak French. I did French at school, and I was au pair in a family in Paris, so that probably helped. And then when I lived in Spain, I spoke Spanish as well, so that helped. I just listen. I like to try and write good dialogue.
And I suppose, talking of language, clearly your Italian is very fluent. Are you completely
well,
fluent?
I understand it, because he speaks Italian. Yeah. We've got a daughter between us that he speaks Italian to. She's now 32, and I understand what they're saying. But when I try and speak Italian, he says, you know, you're speaking Spanish. Don't you know the difference? I know I don't. No. Which annoys him intensely. So I've given up even trying to speak. I just speak English to them. It's like with Afrikaans. You know, I understand it, but I mean, we speak English. I lived in Darling for 9 years. There, we used to go to dinner parties. Everyone spoke Afrikaans. We'd speak English.
You almost have too much. Your cup is overflowing. Since you mentioned that you were an au pair in France, I too was an au pair. And I looked after two little boys. And I found when I came back, the only French I had was all to do with the nursery and how to, you know, go pee-pee and how to go dodo and all those sort of... So my language was pretty bleak. But I'm thinking about the language of Italy is the language of food. As you say, all the idioms that they use are all to do with food. Food just crops up all the time in the book, and it made me really quite hungry just reading it. Did you plan that? Did the food just arrive? Is it, again, were you listening to Emilio's culinary stories?
Yeah, I thought I would first do a food book, a book about Italian food. And that was what it was going to be. It was going to be nonfiction, just a book about Italian food. And then I just decided, no, this is boring. Let's try and get some action here. And then I decided I was going to bring in this character. And then it didn't seem enough. Now, what are we going to do with him? And that was when I thought I'll bring him to South Africa.
What did you learn writing this book? Am I right? It is your first novel?
No, it's not. It's the second one. No,
okay.
It's the third. Well, it's sort of the third. I mean, I've written them at the same time sort of thing. No. What did I learn? That's a tricky one.
Okay. Well, while you're thinking about that, you mean you were writing more than one book at the same time?
Well, I started one early on while I was working for Style magazine. It was a book based on my son, who's a world scorpion expert, amazingly enough. He's in New York, where he's in the American Museum of Natural History. And I thought I'd base something on him. I turned it into snakes rather than scorpions. So that one's actually hanging in there, ready to go too. And then I also started this one on my grandfather, Siege of Ladysmith Diary. So I wrote that one as well, sort of while I was writing this one. So, you know, you skip from one to the next. It gives you a break from one novel. Actually,
are you able to do that? I mean, very often I've heard that people, when they write books, they closet themselves away. They can completely self-isolate, if the right expression, I suppose, and just focus on that. But to divide your brain between a few different stories...
It gives you a break. I think that's essential. Then you come back feeling fresh, because you can get sort of bogged down. You come back and you look at it with a fresh eye, the eye of a reader. Actually, I do a hell of a lot of rewriting and polishing and looking at it again and again, and they all take me a long time. I mean, they really do. I mean, I wrote Pistola over a period of years.
Oh, really?
Mm.
So you had, I'm sort of getting here a plait of wonderful woven things, like one of those plaited loaves of bread, all these different things. And eventually, it's one thing to start, it's another thing entirely to come to an end.
The worst is the ending, writing the ending.
I can only but imagine, because you've had all these sort of wonderful experiences that you've been taking Pistola through and your readers through, all these divine things, and suddenly, oh, that's it, all over. How did you cope with the ending? I mean, not just the content of the ending, but how did you feel when you came to the end?
No, you feel sad, and the readers also feel sad, and they all say, oh, we wish there's going to be a sequel. There can't be a sequel to Pistola, because his story sort of ends there. But I've got another Italian young guy, which I've just finished that novel as well. That's going to be, hopefully Penguin will love it and it'll appear next year, which is set in Kenya, which is also loosely based on Emilio, because he went to Kenya before he came to South Africa. He had a brother-in-law who'd been in the prisoner of war there, prisoner of war camp. They had them in Kenya as well. And then I'm going to take him with me. I'm already planning a sequel to him because I think he's interesting. He's going to go to Buenos Aires where I've been, and I'm doing some research on that. So, you know, it all goes on. I mean, the thing is you've got all this drive and this energy that has got to find, especially now while we're sitting at home, find an outlet.
It seems that you, as I keep alluding to, you've got so much material. Now that you've got one between the covers and it's out there, are you sitting down and thinking, right, now I've got to be more disciplined, I've got to be like Maeve Binchy, who brings out, I don't know, one, two, three, however many it is a year. You know, are you going to control your urge to write in a way that's quite disciplined? Or are you quite disciplined?
No. Look, I am. I write all the time, but it's not a question of now it's 9 o'clock, I'm going to sit down and write. I write when I can, whenever it's easy, and I enjoy it. I mean, the main thing to me is that I've got to do something that I love doing. I'm not doing it with... There's not a lot of money involved in writing novels, especially in South Africa. So that's not what I'm doing. I'm just doing it because I love doing it. And it's another world you can lose yourself in. I think I've always enjoyed that.
And it gets you out of the kitchen.
That's right.
Just last question. You know, I've got this picture of you sitting in your little studio, your office, writing away, type. What is sitting next to you? Are you a coffee drinker? Do you have little stop and have little food breaks? I mean, with all this food in the story, I can only imagine that you must have felt a little bit hungry all the time.
Now listen,
do you eat while you're writing?
Terrified of getting fat in this. No, thank you very much. No. I have endless cups of what you call herbal tea. Endless cups of herbal tea, no milk, no sugar, just kind of keeping the fluid going. That's all we have. Emilio will say, and salad. Emilio will make the salad. Are you ready for a bit of salad now? You know, he's amazing. He's a very good cook. So, I mean, that's where, you know, that's where it comes in. And, I mean, he wakes in the morning and says, what are we having for supper tonight? Which is, you know, I think not common among non-Italians, frankly.
And I suppose, very lastly of all, you've managed to maintain a good relationship through all this writing. He hasn't been, he hasn't felt jealous of you sitting closeted away writing all the time, and he hasn't felt betrayed by you sharing so much of his story.
No, he loves it because, you know, he often tells me, he'll start rambling on about something that he remembers, and it'll suddenly give me an idea, oh my goodness, I've got to now include that, and then I'll go and quickly put that in the middle of the book somewhere. This is a nice bit that I actually like, or this song that's appeared, or this poem, because they used to write poems, you know, things like that. That's the current one that I'm doing now, songs and poems.
Hilary Prendini Toffoli, thank you very much. And Hilary's book is called Loves and Miracles of Pistola. And one more time, let's have it in Italian.
Amores e miracolos de Pistola.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Nancy.
And just as a postscript, Hilary was happy to admit in the interview, you might remember, that she sometimes gets her Italian and her Spanish mixed up, which she did with the title, as she told me later. So Loves and Miracles of Pistola in Italian is not the Spanish Amores e Miracolos di Pistola, as she said, but Amori e Miracoli di Pistola. So now we know. Thanks, Hilary.